Wednesday, April 9th, 2014. Committee members present, Vice Chair Senator Dyson, Senator Michicki, and Senator French. Both Senators Faircloth and Bishop are on Finance Committee. I believe they're still tied up. Senator McGuire will be on her way shortly. Recording Secretary Ann Krekelberg, faithfully here. Thank you, Ann. Helping us with the audio is Claire Gross. And my aide, Lindsay Williams, is up here assisting us. And I'm going to pause for just a moment, since this is near the end of our Senate Resources Committee meetings for this legislature, to commend my aide, Lindsay, for her outstanding assistance to the committee this year. And I just want to thank her. All right. So I have an item of housekeeping I want to take care of before we proceed. Last night I received a letter from Senator French. Committee members have all seen the letter, as well as Senator French's subsequent press release today. He makes an interesting request, that is that we put people speaking to us today under oath, but this is unprecedented and inappropriate. Springing an under oath requirement on invited citizens at the last minute is not only unfair, but unprofessional. I've consulted other senators on the committee. None supports the criminal justice approach to this committee meeting. The people speaking to us today are asked to share trend lines that they see based on the economic climate and the work that's being done on the North Slope locations during this just now concluding winter work season. So I will not be placing people under oath who are presenting to the committee today. So with that aside,
can I just have 1 minute to respond, please?
It's not really a debatable issue. Thank you very much, Senator French.
I'll do it under special.
As you certainly may. As the chair, it is my decision, and I've gotten a legal consultation on that.
I guess as a point of personal privilege, I will say that
Senator French, you're out of order.
The only word in your
brief at ease.
I'm going to keep talking.
So, on the agenda today, we're going to be hearing from the Department of Revenue, and then following that, we're going to be hearing from some of the companies producing up on the North Slope. So, the first person to present today is Deputy Commissioner Bruce Tangerman. So, welcome, Commissioner. If you would come forward, identify yourself for the record, and give us your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bruce Tangerman, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. Thank you, and members of the committee, for giving me the opportunity to come before you. The presentation that I'll be going through, we did roll out a spring forecast update. This really concentrates on the production side of the forecast. Since we're in resources, I thought that was the emphasis that would be acceptable to the committee. And I'll start with a refresher course on some of the changes we made to the production forecast. We saw, looking back over the last 10, 20 years, that the previous methodology was really overshooting with an overly optimistic production forecast. So we saw some opportunities to put a more conservative production forecast out there, really for the understanding and the benefit of the decision makers, the executive branch and the legislature, because this is used for budgeting. It's not predicting that this is exactly what's going to happen in 10 years. It's price times production to give you a sense of what the revenue streams will look like. And the goal was, after overshooting for two decades in a row on the production forecast, the goal was to put a line, my own personal goal was to put a production forecast line out there and beat it for a change. And into the presentation, we'll see that we're moving in that direction. So that's really what the goal was. So I'll walk through some of the reasons why we undertook the change to the production forecast methodology.
Excuse me 1 second, Mr. Tangerman. If committee members could hold their questions till the end. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've all seen the mountain production forecast historical, and there's a couple things that I like to point out when I'm using this graph. Back when oil first started flowing, there were really only two pockets. There was Prudhoe and there was Kuparuk. Start producing it, they were probably fairly easy to predict, to forecast off of, currently producing. As we go through the calendar years, you see more and more colors coming on. And especially in the late 90s, early 2000s, I really like that bump there that shows where we actually added production. And we did turn our production graph around. So as we proceed into the 2010-2013 area, it's interesting to point out also that while Prudhoe and Kuparuk are clearly the two biggest slices of this onion, there are a lot more slices now than there were back then. And they're smaller slices. So forecasting when these slices of production are going to come on, what they're going to be producing at, is a very difficult projection to make. Slide 4 really speaks directly to why a change in the methodology of production forecasting was required. And I remember in 2011, early in the session, coming out of House Finance and Director Bill Barron pulling me aside and saying, I've got some ideas, there's a better way to do this. And that's really what started this process in putting a more accurate forecast together. And on slide 4, we really see some of the issues, what these different lines are. So, for instance, the top line is what the fall forecast in 2005 was 10 years out. So we're including 13, 14, and 15, the last 3 years of that 10-year forecast. And as you can see, it was, you know, 850,000 barrels a day is what they were projecting back then. Again, 10 years out, big misses. The same for 2007, we missed by about 150,000 barrels. 2009, about 95,000 barrels. Fall 2011 was the last year that we did under the old methodology. And what you really notice in all those different lines, but it's really pronounced in the fall 2011, and you would have seen it in the other ones if you look at them in the first 5 years, is there's always a bump up. And it's what's really showing what's possible, not what's probable. And what we realized was while some things do come on, some things don't come on, some things come on at the level as projected, some things don't, not everything was happening as predicted. And we as a state, relying on those, especially when you're attaching a dollar amount to them, was really leading to false information as far as budgeting and a tool that the executive branch uses and the legislature uses. So you notice the fall 2012, that was the first line, first year where we used the new methodology, and they're more or less straight lines. We recognize the possible, but we don't bank on the possible. And that was really the main takeaway that we were trying to address. So slide 5, this is kind of the tranches that were used under the previous methodology, and we also use these types of buckets during our in the new process also. But currently producing is oil from the wells that are producing. They're a lot more predictable. They're we have a good handle on, we think, on the forecast of what's going to be continuing to come out of the currently producing sections. Under development and under evaluation were what's possible. And under development is a little more solid. It's usually got some funding attached to it. There's been a lot more analysis by the companies. But still, there are areas that would be considered under development that are said to be coming on in 2 years at a certain production level that might get kicked out. For instance, Liberty was once under development. I believe a budget was attached to it, and that's one of the best examples of something that was always 2 years out, which meant there was always a production and there was always a price, so there was always revenue projected from Liberty that never came to fruition. Now they're looking at it from a different way, but it's a very good example of what we as a state were banking on that never came to fruition. And then under evaluation is a little more skeptical, or it's known, but it's not necessarily on the budgeted list quite yet. So under the old methodology, you would take these three tranches, you'd add them together, and that would be the production forecast. The Department of Revenue would sit down with the producers and the other companies that are spending money in our state. They're the experts. They operate the fields. But the state would always take what was hoped for. You know, 10 wells were drilled last year. We think 10 wells will be drilled for the next 10 years. And that was kind of the upper end that was always assumed. So we recognize that we're not the experts. We're not going to say that we think you're wrong by 5,000 barrels here too low, and we think this should be 5,000 barrels higher. That's not our job. They operate the fields. We just knew that some things weren't happening the way we had hoped they were going to happen. So for the fall 2012 forecast, we put in a risk factor, and Director Barron had a lot of helped us quite a bit, helped our economists also. Again, we knew things weren't going to come on 100% as planned. We just weren't in a position to cherry pick which ones we thought. So currently producing was not risked. We had a very good handle on how those fields wells had been operating, and we were able to project them going forward. The new oil was what we were looking at risking. An under evaluation was risked not quite as aggressively as under development, but the bottom line was we were now putting in place, and we knew this going in, that we were going to put a production forecast line out there that was not as rosy as what we'd seen in the past. So while we would love to put a most optimistic forecast out there and know that we weren't going to hit it, it was not responsible, because the bottom line is budget decisions are made on the numbers we provide. And if you're making budget decisions today assuming that something is going to happen in the future that we knew was not happening, is it affecting your budget decisions today? And while it is a conservative line that we put out, the goal is to beat the line, but the goal is also to give you more comfort in the budget numbers and the revenue streams that you're using to make budget decisions today and then planning for the near future. This is a 7 or 8, 9 year look back on production decline rates and barrels produced. I think I'll jump to the second slide. It's similar, but it also includes the way we present in the revenue sources book now. So what we have now is a high case, a forecast case, and a low case, and this is all in the revenue sources book. In the past, the high case was the old methodology. You would assume everything that was hoped for would happen. The forecast line is now, and if you notice in the first 3 or 4 years, it's similar to the high case because most of that is the currently producing oil that we're looking at. The risk really starts that pie, slice of pie above the forecast line, and that's the production that we see as possible. We recognize it, but we don't bank on it for budgetary purposes. And then the low case would be just the currently producing if no new oil came online. And this is where I'd like to point out that while we had some 6, 7, 8% declines over the last several years, in December we were forecasting about 4.1% decline for fiscal year 14, and after 9 months of actuals, I believe, 8 months of actuals, we're now looking at 1.8% decline. So this is the first chance where I get to say that we beat the forecast. And I'm not predicting that we're going to go to zero next year, but I think the folks that will be following me, that's kind of the challenge, is I'm putting a conservative number out there, and it's their job to beat it. And we are starting off the first year under this system with a bang, I think. So it's looking good so far.
Chair, I don't have a question. I just didn't hear the number clearly.
Sure. Could you clarify
decline?
The decline rate, sir? Through the chair, Senator Michicki, the forecast in December for fiscal year 14 was about 4% decline. And then 15, 16, 17 would have been 2% decline, 2% decline, 1% decline. So we recognize that we were climbing our way back to zero, but I think this shows that it's we're possibly getting there a lot quicker than what we anticipated.
All
So now I'll go briefly through some things that are in the forecast that are not in the forecast. And then I think the companies that will follow will be able to speak more directly to the specific projects. There's been a lot of announcements, a lot of capital that's already been invested, and I'll allow them to speak to the details. So in order for a project to make it into the forecast, there has to be well data confirming reservoir. The company has to be actively pursuing development. A budget should be in place. We need to have comfort that they're far enough down the road that we can start counting barrels in anticipation. Projects that are under development, a company has partner alignment, senior management approval. The project has been allocated funds in the company budget. Under evaluation is more the resources known, being pursued, but financial hurdles have not been met. So many of the recent announcements by, for instance, BP, ConocoPhillips, are included in this. Brooks Range, the Mustang project, is included. But it's also important to point out that if we're looking at production estimates starting in FY17, FY18, which is, you know, some of the lead time that's required, we're still risking that. I know there was a big debate around Point Thompson last year that, you know, the contract says 10,000 barrels, yet our forecast had something less than that. And it was merely the risking factor that was applied. Again, it goes back to we're not cherry picking which ones are right and wrong, and we're not looking at contracts. We're just saying that a project that says it's going to be producing 10,000 barrels in 4 years has a little bit of risk to it. It could come in higher, it could come in lower. But when you're trying to put dollars to it, we just wanted to be conservative. So that's a good example of something that's out there a little bit that is risked. What's not in the forecast are undiscovered resources, and there's plenty. I think everybody would agree that the potential on the North Slope is tremendous still. That's one thing we don't debate. We have a tremendous resource up there still. Technologically challenged oil, heavy viscous shale. The shale has been a interesting talking point for the last couple of years. Potential's tremendous. You know, you hear it's three times the size of the Bakken. The problem is you can drive to every square inch of the Bakken, and you can drop a drill bit and start drilling. And if you look at North Dakota, it does look like a checkerboard. We've got one road. It's a gravel road. How are you going to get off that gravel road to do a checkerboard like that? That's a tremendous challenge. Is it something that we're forecasting? No. Is it something that we see on the horizon as a possibility 10 years down the road, 20, who knows how long, but the resource is there. So that's something that we're very encouraged by, but again, we're not banking on dollars coming in from those shale deposits quite yet. Repsol will be speaking to you. A lot of good developments there, a lot of announcements. They've been here for a while now, but we're not including that in our forecast yet. I anticipate very soon that we will be bringing that into the forecast, but that's a good example of a big company buying a lot of acreage and doing a lot of work that hasn't quite made it to that threshold of making it into the revenue sources book. And then, of course, regulatory and federal issues with ANWR, OCS, those are tremendous resources, but again, we don't have those in our RSB and we're not banking on those quite yet. So here's a five-year look at what we had in our December forecast and what we have in our spring updated forecast. The good news is in 14 we're up 13,600 barrels is what we're forecasting. And again, we put a forecast out and we beat it. So that's very, very encouraging. We have based on the information we've heard from the companies, summer field maintenance is expected to be deeper than we originally anticipated. But a lot of that is in preparation for the capital investments that they've announced. So while it's more or less even for this coming fiscal year, 2015, mainly the summer, you can see the blue line is above the fall forecast, and that should be the result of increased production from those investments. So again, I'd love to show a line that's a lot more aggressive and a lot steeper than that, but it's not responsible for what we're doing in this document itself. So where's the production? Future production varies greatly based on projects currently under development or under evaluation. We recognize it, but we don't bank on it today. The potential for significant production increases exist. Forecasting it will occur is not prudent. Revenues projected as sufficient levels of certainty are obtained. Likelihood of development increases with better economic conditions, price, cost, taxes. And again, those are some of the things that could make a project go in 5 years or put it back on the shelf. And many things can cause the project to be delayed or abandoned. So this is a more blown up look from a few slides back of what the old forecasting methodology would have looked like. That would have been the green line. The current forecast line is the black line, and then the low case is basically currently producing only. And the encouraging thing I'm seeing there is out through 2017, it's flattening out. If some of that high case potential comes into play, we're seeing an increase in production. And again, this, when we were showing a 4% decline forecast and then 2%, 2%, 1% for 14, 15, 16, 17, you know, we were getting back to even 4 years out. We're a lot closer to that today. Does that mean we're going to get to zero next year and plus two the year after? I don't know. But the potential's there. And we're moving in the right direction a lot quicker than we anticipated. Slide 14. Again, it's a different way of looking at the previous slide. And this goes directly to the current tax system in place. I'm not here to debate the tax issue, but it does show how the different tranches of oil are addressed. Currently producing is still currently producing. Not GVR eligible is still new oil, but it's not eligible for the 5% credit. It is eligible for the sliding scale credit, which is legacy oil. And then GVR eligible oil is the purple slice there. And again, the upside potential, we put it on there, we address it, we hope for it, but the top line for the forecast is the purple line, basically. Slide 15 looks at the CapEx forecast for the next 10 years. Couple interesting things to note here. First of all, we risk CapEx just like we risk production in the out years. If $1 billion is going to be invested for a project in 8 years, well, if we're risking that production level down, we're also going to risk the CapEx down. But what's interesting here, one of the first takeaways I noticed was in 2014, I think there was a concern about a change from the fiscal between the two tax systems. We're taking that 20% capital credit off the table. And there were some questions, some concerns about whether things would be accelerated to take advantage of that. Well, we actually, if you look at the 2014 column, spring 2013, we had $3.9 billion. Spring 14, $3.7 billion. So it was actually a little less. It wasn't actually an acceleration of expenditures. But between spring of 13 and spring of 14, what we see is between $800 million and $1.3 billion of additional investment that we're forecasting. And that goes back to the projects that the companies following me will speak to. But again, it's consistent year to year, and that's why you're seeing the difference between the green line and the red and blue line, whichever one you want to look at, but they're both more investment. And the important thing about when you talk about investment, it's not the spending side. It's investment in production. And that was really the main thing about the 20% credit was we took that off the table, but yet we're still seeing an increase in capital investment. So slide 16 is the OPEX side. Not much to speak about here. Still an expensive place to do business, obviously, but it's fairly consistent over the last couple of forecasts. And that's all I have for this. I'm more than happy to take questions.
Great. I think there probably are some. Questions? Senator French.
Sure, ma'am. Thanks, Madam Chair. I'll make 2 points. One, I'm going to put on the record my objection to the Chair's use of the word unprofessional to describe my letter. Thank you, Madam Chair. Number two, let's focus on slide 11. Slide 11 is the 2 years of production forecasts. Spring, the current one in blue, fall in red. And you're saying we're going to produce 536,000 barrels in FY14, and you're claiming that's an increase. But for me to believe it really is an increase means I have to ignore the other two most recent forecasts for FY14. One said we'd make the same amount, 536. The other we'd make actually more, 540,000. Mm-hmm. All you've done basically is get us back to the forecast from a year ago of spring 2013. Mm-hmm. Want to comment on that?
Absolutely. It's a very good question. I would look directly back to, let's see, this slide. The walking around decline number that everybody had been using for the past several years was 6%. What we saw was 7.26.6.34.8.2 was the decline rate from last year. So decline was accelerating a lot quicker than we had anticipated. So to get back to those original numbers in the previous forecast was a much bigger uphill climb for us, which really makes getting to 1.8% that much more incredible. And I'm very enthused and encouraged by that. But while the forecasts going back a couple years were different, the fact that we're following up an 8.2% decline with 1.8% is, I think, the main takeaway.
Madam Chair?
Follow-up?
Yeah, thanks. And you're aware that a year ago, ConocoPhillips' vice president told a gathering of investment analysts the company was planning on a 2-3% decline rate from its North Slope operations during the next few fiscal years. You're aware of that statement by the ConocoPhillips' vice president?
Through the chair, Senator French, I had heard that, yes.
So what we're seeing is what they predicted was a lower decline rate.
Through the chair, Senator French, I think there's other companies involved on the North Slope. It's not just ConocoPhillips. But the bottom line is, no matter who you talk to in this building, more production was the goal. So I'm enthused by the 1.8%. We got there. That's the whole point, is throughput. And taking advantage of the resource we have. So, yes, we're under 2% now. That's great news for all of us.
Other questions?
I have one.
Senator Machicki.
Well, I used to run a little city, and this is just kind of a parable, if you will, but city managers historically give low revenue predictions. And you do very conservative budgeting, and then when it comes at the end of the year, everybody's really surprised and really happy at those higher sales taxes. And I don't see my city manager in here right now, but he operated. I'm very proud of the way he operated. And for years, the state didn't operate that way, and everyone was somewhat they weren't excited at the results. So what we see now is we've gotten a more accurate revenue predictions, okay? And I support that always, and I think our spending should be matched accordingly, however. So here's the question for you. We hear people using those accurate numbers against us in this building as though that's a bad thing. So we're accurately predicting now, and we're seeing a decrease in that decline. How do we ensure as we go out forward? So one of the questions I have, and I'll nail it down here, Madam Chair, I promise. I don't see how you can even remotely accurately predict CapEx. So when we're tightening our models down on future revenue predictions, are there areas we can improve?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, as far as the CapEx predictions, we rely on what the private sector tells us and what they anticipate the spending to be. The reason we risk it is we're under a net tax system. So the dollars they anticipate spending do affect the revenue stream to the state. And that's one of the reasons we risk it. I hope that started to address some of the question, but it's a double-edged sword, really. We all want investment. We want capital spent on production. But when those increases in capital occur, it affects the net tax system and therefore the revenue to the state. So it's important that the investment is spent on what we're trying to incentivize, and that's production. And we believe the system in place is leading to that. That was the whole point of it. But I'll listen to more of the question if I didn't quite touch on what you wanted.
Just to follow up, Madam Chair, just on a net tax system, I'm just wanting to tie together those two ends. I mean, we have a tendency to look at production, and the aggregate's probably more important. So that was just my point. The best we can on understanding future expenditures that are able to be deducted.
And through the chair, Senator Michicki, I will mention that back to your days of running a city, the spring forecast does show an increase in about $374 million for fiscal year 14. So that is good news that we're not coming to you and saying it's short $374 million. There's more because of the increase in production. So that's the good news that we're presenting.
Good.
Thank you. It is good news. Appreciate it.
Good. I don't see any other questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Tangerman. Great. So now we'll go to reports from the field. And the first company up is Repsol. Bill Hardiman is coming forward, and he is going to speak, make a presentation for Repsol. So welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bill Hardiman, project manager for Repsol based in Anchorage, Alaska. We welcome the opportunity to present to the Senate Resources Committee. Thank you for inviting us. So our views are based on our perspective as still a relatively new player on the North Slope, currently engaged in the exploration and appraisal phase. We have a brief update, but first I'd like to offer a little history about Repsol and our arrival in Alaska. Thank you. Repsol E&P USA is the U.S. upstream operating subsidiary of Repsol SA, an integrated international oil and gas company headquartered in Madrid, Spain, with 25,000 employees worldwide and exploration and production activities in 31 countries, as shown on the map. Repsol is ranked 112th on the 2013 Fortune 500 list. So Repsol has a history with, let's say, high political risk countries. We have suffered several examples of contracts being changed, expropriation of assets, and civil unrest leading to lost business opportunities and erosion of value. As a result, several years ago, Repsol made a strategic decision to rebalance its portfolio in favor of lower risk opportunities, such as those found in OECD type of countries. Repsol was looking at the Alaska North Slope for some time. We even took leases in the federal waters of the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. But due to the uncompetitive fiscal terms for the Alaska North Slope, the economics were not attractive to Repsol, and we did not enter. It wasn't until 2011 when oil tax reform was introduced and it was apparent that Alaska was serious about making the North Slope more competitive that Repsol entered. At that time, Armstrong Oil and Gas presented an opportunity for establishing a material North Slope position. There were risks associated with coming in at this time before the certainty of oil tax reform, but it was a good opportunity that was a good fit for Repsol's strategy. Additionally, if Repsol would have waited for more certainty in regards to oil taxes, the opportunity would likely have been lost or the price of entrance would have gone up. So, at that time, Repsol took a bit of a calculated risk and came to Alaska in March of 2011, acquiring 70% interest in approximately 500,000 acres on the North Slope and counting on oil tax reform. So Repsol immediately set out to aggressively explore and appraise the acreage, all the while keeping an eye on oil tax reform. We are now completing our third winter season of activity, and as the map here shows, we have drilled 9 wells to date on the North Slope. We've acquired significant amount of 3D seismic data, and we've increased our acreage position to approximately 750,000 gross acres. We've invested more than $500 million in our Alaska project to date, and we announced 3 discoveries from our campaign last year. I'm going to just point out a few aspects of the map really quick. Repsol acreage, it's kind of an orange color. These are the leases we hold on the North Slope. Of course, to the east is Prudhoe. In the central is Kuparuk River. The wells we primarily have drilled to date are in this, the Colville River runs through this area. This is the delta area in here. Most of our wells have been concentrated in this area. We've also drilled wells to the south here towards the foothills and one over here this season, south of Kuparuk River. The discoveries we announced last year were in the Colville River delta area, and we've also acquiring some 3D seismic data this winter as well, and that's shown on the map. The passage of the new tax law last year gave Repsol the confidence to move ahead with an aggressive campaign this winter, including 3 wells drilled with 3 drilling rigs and 2 large 3D seismic acquisition projects. We've put a significant number of people to work, and we have more than 600 positions on the North Slope associated with this program. So this is our activity this winter. First, we've built an ice road or 2 ice roads. They're shown in blue here. We've got about 30 miles of ice road constructed to our locations in the Colville River Delta and this location south of Kuparuk River. We've built an ice runway where we fly crews in and out 5 days a week. We have 2 drilling locations here. One is actually in the river delta, this Kubrick number 7. Another one's just off the delta to the east, Kubrick number 5. We have separate drilling rigs on each of those presently right now. These 2 wells are appraising the discoveries we announced last year. And then we have a drilling rig over here in this 2-2 location currently drilling as well. We have 2 large 3D seismic acquisition projects going on. This winter is shown in the large rectangular area shown here. And this winter's program should amount to approaching $250 million in investment with the 600 positions or so that I mentioned. It's important to note that the Department of Revenue's forecast does not include production forecasts from Repsol. And this is because Repsol needs to complete the appraisal of last year's discoveries before making a development decision. If our discoveries appraise well, and if the tax law stands, I am optimistic that we will get a project approved internally. And hopefully this will be the first of several North Slope development projects for Repsol. The state oil tax structure is fundamental and vitally important to all of this activity that we have been undertaking on the North Slope. When we came here, it was under the assumption that oil taxes were going to be made more competitive. So when SB 21 passed, we were pleased that the state put in place a more competitive environment, and we aggressively pursued our exploration program. Under SB 21, the current tax structure is competitive. A competitive tax structure increases the chances that a moderately sized opportunity or opportunities will get developed. And one of the most important points is that if we have a marginal field, one that would not have been commercial under ACES, it has a much better chance of being developed under the new tax law. Repsol came to Alaska to invest in a more stable environment, to invest the billions of dollars to bring projects to production. A company needs reasonable assurance that the tax structure is stable. So we appreciate the opportunity to speak today, and thank you. I'm happy to take your questions.
Great. Thank you, Bill, for your testimony. Questions for Mr. Hardam?
I'll ask Mr.
Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You made statements about how you were encouraged by the tax reduction
Like you said, the passage of the new tax gave us the confidence to go forward. And the last statements that you read were about making decisions based on tax considerations. I'm wondering what your internal rate of return is on your investments, what your hurdle rate is, and whether the tax structure, which we've been told over and over, is actually taking in less, that we're taking in more right now than we would under ACES, how that plays into your decisions.
Through the chair, Senator French, thank you for the question. We do not operate under a minimum per se rate of return. It's more about an evaluation of the investment opportunities we have in front of us. So, of course, it's going to need to be positive. That pretty much goes without saying. But we have a limited budget for investments around the world. So any projects we're looking at here on the North Slope are going to have to compete against the opportunities that Repsol has in the rest of the United States and the 30 or so other countries around the world that, you know, I highlighted there on the map. And please, did that answer the question? Or please continue.
Maybe I didn't say it as clear as I should have. What projects are you considering pursuing now that are economic under SB 21 that were not economic under ACES? And can you explain the economic rationale between the two?
Okay, through the chair, Senator French. So we're still early days in evaluating our opportunities on the North Slope. And we don't have our opportunities, let's say, fully characterized from a geoscience or engineering perspective right now to where, you know, we're necessarily ready to make those decisions. So the first opportunity that we're pursuing is the one in the Colville River Delta where we've announced the discoveries. So we announced, you know, we had three wells there last year, announced discoveries in all three. Let's call that collectively an opportunity for development. And that's the one we're focused on right now. And we will be finishing up the two wells there this winter, end of this month. It'll be take a number of months to analyze the results of that. And at that time, you know, we're hopeful that we will have enough information to be making that decision. So that's the opportunity we're looking at right now. We're not quite there yet.
Last question, if I could.
Follow-up?
Thanks. Do you think we've been told over and over that the current tax rate is higher right at this little snapshot in time than ACES is? Do you think this high tax rate is hurting investment and hurting your ability to invest in Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator French. So I think that that's a comparison between the old tax structure, ACES and SB 21, and it has to do with the current oil price, I think.
Right. And your cost of production.
So, you know, our first development project would be a number of years in front of us still. And so we're looking at forecasts out there a number of years down the road, and then for production that goes a number of years down the road from that. And so we're looking at a range of prices, and based on that range of, when I say prices, you know, oil prices, based on that range of prices, the tax structure under SB 21 is much more favorable to Repsol's investments when we look at a full cycle economics than the old tax structure ACES. And it does depend on your forecast of oil prices.
Thank you, Madam.
Very good. Thank you. And we heard a bit about that from Analytica this morning, who talked about looking at the full economics of the full project over the whole life of the project. Senator Machiki.
Yeah, thanks for being here. I appreciate it. And thanks for being in the state. But the question I have specifically is, you were sort of a target of fans of ACES. Smaller companies, you were a target of fans of ACES. And we didn't see a lot of it. We saw some. What has changed your mind specifically with the current regime, tax regime, and what kind of success will not only keep you around but may draw a significantly larger number of investors that are of your market cap size?
Through the chair, Senator Machiki. So if I understood the first question, it was there's a understanding or a view that Repsol was a fan of ACES?
No, my question was, a lot of folks that were fans of ACES in this building thought that it would be more likely to result in a much higher level of interest from smaller companies like Repsol and yet smaller yet.
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Michiki. So, yeah, as I said, when we looked at opportunities in Alaska under that tax structure, it was not advantageous to us in our view. You know, we looked at the so a benefit of that tax structure was you could get some tax credits to offset your initial investments, and that, while important to some companies that might be capitally have constraints on acquiring financing, that wasn't necessarily the case with us. So that wasn't such a big issue for us. It was more the basics of full cycle economics, and it just didn't compete. And SB 21 is much more competitive in our view. Was there a second question?
Follow up, Senator Michiki.
Yeah, I mean, the follow up question, I mean, I'm hearing very few people today saying that ACE is where they want to go. The follow up question was, what similar economics or what similar conditions might draw additional smaller companies, and I don't care what size a company are, as long as they can operate as expected in Alaska in a safe manner and such. But what kind of sustainable economics do you see will draw additional companies like Repsol, similarly sized companies to Repsol?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, Repsol views the current tax structure under SB 21 as competitive, and you know, it certainly was enough to attract us here. I mean, we didn't know the exact terms of how it would be, but we see that as competitive and should attract other investment in the North Slope besides our own. Stability is also important. I think, you know, for Repsol, stability is another important thing. So the more we can keep it stable here, I think that's better for long-term investment as well.
One more quick one, really?
Sure. Okay.
Just a quick question. Are you seeing good things that are sort of encouraging you just in your experience so far in your test wells and the activity that Repsol's invested in so far?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki. Yeah, we are very encouraged with what we're seeing so far. We have discovered oil. It's of good quality. Costs are high on the North Slope. It's a challenge for us. So, you know, having a good competitive tax structure in place, you know, helps to balance that somewhat. But yes, we're very encouraged. You know, Repsol, this is a very important asset for Repsol, and we continue. I'm getting a lot of encouragement, you know, from my headquarters for this project.
Great. You know, the other thing I observe about your exploration and possible development is you would qualify for the gross value reduction credit for production. Senator McGuire had a question also.
Thank you, through the chair. Thank you, Mr. Hardin, for being here today. You know, for me, you can obviously, you're in a capital, so there are political overtones to a lot of the questions and the things. But for me, you know, in voting for Senate Bill 21, and what I want to see today is increased production. You know, I want to see development, jobs for Alaskans. And I've spent some time with other independents that aren't on the agenda today, and very candid conversations where they have said to me that if Senate Bill 21 is repealed, that it will significantly alter their investment and development plans in our state. And I really think it's important, if you have some thoughts on that, to put those on the record about how the potential for going back to ACES would impact Repsol's development plans in the state.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire, thank you for the question. A repeal of Senate Bill 21 would certainly negatively affect our investment decisions going forward. Senate Bill 21, we feel, makes Alaska more competitive. It makes a moderately sized opportunity on the North Slope, you know, more competitive. It certainly makes our potential investments on the North Slope more competitive and look more favorable. If we were to go back to the tax structure under ACES, our investments would look less favorable. And on top of that would be the instability we would see, and both of these factors would negatively impact Repsol's decision-making of development projects.
Good. Follow-up, Senator
Moore. I do. And just to follow up, and part of what the conversations that I've had with some of the other independents is the dividing between exploration and production. And maybe you can talk a little bit about how important that is to the extent that it is, and how you think through your development plans. Because I think one of the things in the debate years ago when we were dividing between legacy fields and independents was the focus on capital costs. And certainly that's an issue. But at the point at which you reach production and then are paying those higher taxes, how does that impact your future development plans?
Through the chair, Senator McGuire. So this is talking about a comparison between the tax credits you would receive under ACES and how that would offset your capital investment versus higher taxes in the future. Okay.
Right.
So again, we don't, when we look at an investment, we're not compartmentalizing exploration and development. It's a full and it's looked at in a whole, as a whole. And in our view, when we look at things, the current tax structure is much more competitive. The more favorable production tax offsets the benefits we would have received, offsetting the initial capital investment.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much, Mr. Hardam,
for
presenting today. Next up, we have Scott Jepson with ConocoPhillips. Welcome, Mr. Jepson.
Thank you. Madam Chairman and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Jepson. I'm Vice President of External Affairs for ConocoPhillips. On behalf of ConocoPhillips, I want to thank the committee for the opportunity to be here today and to talk about ConocoPhillips' activities on the North Slope fields that we operate. I am going to be talking about forward-looking statements today. So as always, when we do that, I need to provide a cautionary statement. And the gist of this cautionary statement is our future performance could differ materially from the expectations outlined today. And the risks and uncertainties that affect our performance are outlined in that legalese behind you there. So if you want to understand what they are, feel free to read that at your leisure. So there are three things that I want to talk about. First, I'd like to talk about what's happening in 2014. Second, I'll give you an exploration update on what's happened this last winter with our exploration drilling. And then lastly, I'm going to touch upon the plans that we have announced since SB 21 was passed. We've announced about $2 billion in new investments that will add materially to production on the North Slope. So let's start with 2014. Our capital budget for 2014 is about $1.7 billion. That's the net capital budget. That covers all of our activities for Kuparik, Alpine, Prudhoe Bay, Point Thompson, Alaska Gas Project, Cook Inlet, basically everything that we invest in the state. So I just want to make that clear. All the rest of the numbers that I'm going to talk about are gross numbers that are a little bit easier to relate to. Our 2014 budget is about $600 million more than it was in 2013 and about double what it was in 2012. So there are some big chunks of that budget that I want to talk about first. The first one is CD5. I think, as most of you remember, we spent about 6 years trying to get CD5 permitted. And once we finally got the permit, we'd spent a lot of time and effort going through that process, and we just made the decision that we were going to go ahead and proceed on CD5 regardless of the tax framework that we were in at the time. That's a $1 billion gross project. We're going to spend about $400 million this year. We're now in the process of building the bridges, laying down the gravel. We have about 600 people or so employed right now on that project. If everything goes according to plan, we'll see first production in 2015 at a peak rate of about 16,000 barrels a day. The other big chunk that we're spending this year on capital is what we call renewal projects. Probably one of the biggest one is we're replacing 14 miles of 30-inch pipeline that brings water from our Lick Talk Point seawater plant back into the middle of the field for use for pressure maintenance in the Kaparik field. We also are installing additional pigging facilities, which will allow us to go and maintain our pipelines, make sure we understand, you know, the mechanical integrity of those flow lines. And then we have other renewal projects as well. Those renewal projects at about $400 million in 2014. Now, all those projects above the line, those are projects that we were going to do with or without changes to the tax framework. And with the exception of CD5, they're pretty representative of the type of projects that we've historically done over the last 6 or 7 years when we had ACEs in place. What we're starting to see now is the tip of the iceberg of newer projects that we have the decision to start taking forward, take to our board of directors for approval since SB 21 was passed. One of those is Drill Site 2S, and I'll come back to that in just a moment, but we're spending about $70 million this year to put gravel down for a new drill site in Kaparik. And we've also brought in two additional rigs to the Kaparik field. One of those we brought in 2013, and that rig has added about 2,000 or 3,000 barrels a day right now of production. It's doing mostly workovers. The other rig started up in January, and it's going to be doing new drilling. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. So I'm going to take just a moment and talk about what this means in terms of jobs. The increased scope that we have in our capital spend this year has resulted in bringing 1,750 new people to the North Slope to help us accomplish the scope of work that I've just outlined. And this first bullet point up here shows you what they're working on. There's about 1,100 of them working on CD5 and the seawater pipeline, the renewal projects. About 275 working on the projects that we've announced since SB 21 was passed. Then I also provided a breakdown in terms of where they're coming from. We have about 480 that are coming from the Union Halls in Fairbanks, and I've put down the various locals that they're coming from. You might notice we have one carpenter. We don't use a lot of wood on the North Slope these days. But nonetheless, we have a carpenter. And we also have about 900 non-union jobs up there as well. And, of course, it takes engineering efforts in town to get these projects up and running and to do the engineering that's required. And, of course, we also have fabrication that's going on in both Anchorage and Fairbanks. So there's about another 350 jobs there. So the work that we've got going on this year has been fairly substantial in scope and is having a big impact on the Alaskan economy, bringing a lot of people up there. If you look on the right-hand side, we have a list of companies that we're doing business with to help support the work that's going on right now. That's not the total list. Those are just the bigger contractors that we're working with. But obviously, the work that we have has a big impact on the Alaskan business and business community. So let me now move into exploration. First, let me talk a little bit about this map to get you oriented. In the upper right-hand corner, the blue outline there is the outline of the Colville River Unit, which is where the Alpine Field is located. And the various CD 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 that you see there, the various drill sites for the Alpine Field. Now, as you move to the west, you move into NPRA. NPRA is that dashed line that kind of runs through the western portion of the Alpine Field. And the first unit there is the Greater Moose's Tooth Unit, and then the unit to the north of that is the Beartooth Unit. This last year, we drilled two wells, one called Flat Top and one called Rendezvous 3. Just to back up a moment, we're planning a new drill site in NPRA called Greater Moose's Tooth 1, or GMT1, and I'll talk more about that on the next slide. But the Flat Top well is an accumulation different than the GMT1 accumulation, and if it's successful, and we're not ready to announce results on that yet, then we could potentially develop it from the GMT1 pad. And as you move to the southwest, the Rendezvous 3 well, as the name suggests, is the third well in a series that we've drilled out there. The previous two were drilled in 2000 and 2001. This is a follow-up well to get us more data. We're in the process of testing that well. And assuming it looks good, it could lead to another drill site to the southwest of GMT-1. I put a potential timeline on there for development just to give you an idea of how we're viewing development of these assets. You see CD5 on the top line there, and then underneath that you see GMT-1. And if GMT-2 is successful, it would be sequential after GMT-1. The idea is we want to level load our resources. If we were to try to stack all these on top of each other, we'd put a big strain on manpower resources, equipment resources, engineering resources in the state. Doing it this way, it fits within the constraints that we have in terms of available manpower resources on the slope. And, you know, hopefully long term, we'll be able to do more of this with Alaskans than if you stacked everything together. So it's a fairly efficient way to do the business. So lastly, I wanted to conclude with a summary of the plans that we have announced since SB 21 was passed. I mentioned earlier that we've brought two rigs into the Kuparuk field. The workover rig is doing about 25 to 30 workovers a year. The drilling rig is drilling grassroots wells. That's a lot slower process. We get about 10 of those per year with that particular rig. The drill site 2S that I mentioned earlier, that's the result of exploration work we did in 2012, the Sharktooth well. We went out to the southwest portion of the field, and we discovered some additional A and C sands that look good enough that we're now proposing to move ahead with development. If we are successful in getting funding, that'll be a $600 million project with about 240 people employed doing construction, and we should bring out about 8,000 barrels a day peak production in 2016. As you're going to see with most of these projects, in the state we're in right now, we'll be taking these to our board and executive management late in 2014 for approval. So right now we're still on all of these working on engineering and the process that we need to do to get them to that point. The next one is GMT-1. GMT-1 is an interesting prospect. It's going to be fairly substantial in terms of volume, potentially as much as 30,000 barrels a day when it comes online in 2018. It's going to be similar in scope to CD5, except we don't have to build the bridges. It costs about $900 million and 500 to 600 people peak workforce during construction. And then lastly, we have recently announced additional investment in the Viscous oil field in the Kuparuk River unit called the Westsac. We are looking at drilling some additional wells off of an existing drill site in Kuparuk, the 1H drill site. We're going to put some additional gravel down. We're going to move out of the core area for Westsac into an area that we call, the Northeast Westsac. We expect about 9,000 barrels a day from that investment in 2018, and again about 150 people to help construct it. About $450 million will be spent in the development of that project. So what these represent right now is really kind of the tip of the iceberg. These are the projects that we've brought to the point where we're ready to submit permits, start talking actively with our partners about funding, start putting the process in place to take them to our executive management for funding later this year. There are more projects that we're working on, but they have not been matured to the point where we're ready to talk about them publicly yet. If you take a look at the production profiles that we have for these three projects that I've talked about above, we're looking at probably more than 40,000 barrels a day of new production in 2018. And if you put CD5 in there, potentially as much as 50,000 barrels a day in 2018. So quite clearly, the investment is significant. We're talking billions of dollars. We're talking hundreds of jobs. Just in terms of the direct people that I've talked about here, it'll be much like 2014 in terms of total employment on the slope. It'll bring thousands of jobs to the North Slope. And, of course, it's going to have a big impact on the Alaskan business community and Alaskan economy. So I think, we've seen some good things announced since SB 21 was passed. I think, one of the questions that will always be asked is, well, if the referendum passes and we go back to ACES, what would you do, what would you not do? And what I can tell you is that the positive business climate that SB 21 provides is really adding a lot of momentum and a lot of support for investment in these projects in our executive headquarters and with our partners. If we go backwards, if we go back to the investment climate that existed under ACES, which was not a positive investment climate, we will go back and take a much harder look at all of these, and I can't tell you that all these projects move ahead. There's a possibility that some might move ahead, some might move slower, some might terminate sooner. we might not do some of these, but it will be a very negative, have a very negative impact in terms of our view in making these investments. So again, I want to thank the legislature for passing tax reform last year. I think it was a very substantial move, as you can tell from the comments from Repsol and ourselves, and I suspect from the other producers that are going to be here today. It has had a very positive impact on investment on the North Slope. So with that, I'll conclude my comments and take any questions that you may have.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Jepson. Questions for Mr. Jepson? Senator French.
Yes, Madam Chair. Two questions on two slides. If we can go back to slide four, please. Thanks. And I'll just start with a 30-second brief personal reminiscence. That's a picture of CPF-1 at Kaparik there in the upper right-hand corner. One of my favorite places in Alaska. I mean, seriously, as I spent 8 years there, and I could tell you stories about every little pipe and every little connection and some of the good things and some of the bad things that happened there, but it's a great place, and I still have friends working there. But the point of the slide was not to indulge me in a personal reminiscence, but to go back to the points about Kaparik renewal projects, the $400 million you're going to spend in 2014 on replacing a seawater line. I assume that's from STP coming into the other facilities and picking another renewal projects. I guess I would term those as maintenance projects, which I'm glad that we're out of the closet. We're able to now to discuss maintenance projects again in open society, because last year maintenance was bad, and maintenance was a horrible thing to be spending money on. And now it's okay because we passed SB 21, and maintenance is, I guess, good again now. I supported maintenance then. I support it now. I'm glad you're spending the $400 million on maintenance, because you've got to have a seawater treatment plant line to inject seawater into the ground and produce oil out of that, and you got to do picking and so forth. And I guess if you could comment on future maintenance style projects you'll be doing not only at Kaparik but at your other investments.
Senator French, through the chair. I guess what I would like to do is just go back to last year and previous years, and we've never been shy about talking about how much money we spend on renewal projects or maintenance projects, whatever you want to call them. If you go back to last year, we were very plain about how much of our budget was consumed by those sorts of projects. So I guess I would disagree that it's coming out of the closet. We've been talking about this up front for as long as I've been talking about the subject anyway. In terms of how much is coming down the road, I don't have that with me right now. To some extent, it depends upon what kind of issues we uncover. We saw some corrosion in this line, and it became time to replace it. So, we can argue all day, I suppose, about the semantics of renewal versus maintenance, but this is a replacement of a big piece of pipeline. It's not just a repair of a pipeline. These oil fields are, beyond what their expected lives were. You know as well as I do, we didn't think we would be producing oil out of Kaparik at this point in time, nor Prudhoe. They've been here about 40 years, 30 to 40 years, and hopefully they'll be here another 30 to 40 years. So I think what you will see over time is you will see some of the bigger chunks of equipment, bigger pieces of kit that we have on North Slope will be replaced because they've outlived their useful life. I think we're going to continue to see a fair amount of investment in renewal and maintenance projects, and I think you're going to see a lot of employment on the North Slope in those areas. I think, as you've noted and others have noted, we've had high employment on the North Slope during the period of ACES, and a lot of that was due to maintenance-type activities. It wasn't oriented towards projects like Drill Site 2S or GMT1 or News 1H.
If I can just follow up.
Follow up, Senator French?
Probably was not as artful as I should have been in making my remark. I was not aiming that maintenance remark at you, Mr. Jepson, or even anyone out of the industry. It was mainly the debate we heard here in the building. And so, if it came out wrong, I apologize. I was not aiming that at you. It was the debate about passing the bill and how somehow maintenance was bad. I don't think you ever said maintenance was bad, or anybody from the industry ever said maintenance was bad. It was my colleagues, and so I probably should have just left that point for a different time. But let me turn to maybe a more substantive point, if I could, Madam Chair.
Yes, please.
Thanks. To page 7, because this really is kind of where the rubber meets the road, and this is where we're trying to figure out what to do. And you were careful in your remarks about what might happen to these projects and what might not happen if the repeal were to pass. But let me just ask, which of these projects were not economic under ACES?
Senator French, through the chair. Let's go back to the conversation we had last year. We make decisions to invest in projects. We look at a number of economic metrics. We look at NPV. We look at rate of return. We look at cash flow. And one of the biggest issues under ACES was it really capped your cash flow. When you got to a certain point, basically all the upside went to the state. And that puts investment at Alaska at a serious disadvantage, because there are other places where we can go to invest money where we are going to experience the upside. And that's what the debate over ACES was all about. Progressivity really killed the investment climate here in Alaska. So we go and look at projects in Alaska, and we talk about investing a couple billion dollars. We take a look at price sensitivity, and as price goes up, there is no sensitivity in Alaska. We don't make any more money. You know, it is very, very limited. You know, I'll take the absolute off, but it was very little upside. We have other places where we can invest substantial dollars, and we don't have that handicap. So that was the issue with ACES. You know, there are lots of places to invest money, but why come to a place where the business climate is such that you don't have any upside? And SB 21 changed that.
Thank you. Senator McGuire has a question.
Just a statement through the chair, but just to state on the record, too, that the concern, at least from this senator's point of view, wasn't that the industry was spending money on maintenance, but rather that we'd like them to spend more money on drilling and actually production and results. And that, for me, at least my perspective, was the point of Senate Bill 21, was that when you looked at ACES, there was a notion that you could incentivize production by rewarding industry with capital expenditure credits, and it just simply wasn't playing out that way. But at least I'd like to state on the record that I think most senators I know believe that maintenance is important as well. That's certainly a part of sound development and aging fields. But, you know, the goal, and what I'm excited to hear from you today, Scott, and thank you, is new numbers and potential for barrels coming in, new production. So,
absolutely. We certainly know that there were some spills due to flow line corrosion in the past, and it's a key piece of maintaining. We have to maintain those fields. Yes, Senator Machicki.
Yeah, Scott, guy on my hockey team, his name is Brian Gabriel. I like to make things kind of personal. I'm from a small town. He owns Big G Electric, and I'm not there to play right now. Brian doesn't have a lot of free time to play either. They're his little company, little electrical service company, swamped. I have another friend, he owns a place called Davis Block. They used to try to keep their doors open with a job once in a while in the winter just to pay the light bill. Today, he has more employees in the winter than he's ever had in the summer. These are constituents of mine that are enjoying the benefits. Here's the question I have for you. I don't want to ask you for a number. Are the numbers on page 5, which is the jobs, and the number on page 7, which are the projects, significantly higher since the passing of the new tax regime, and would they be adversely affected significantly if we went back? I mean, I think that's a simple question. I'm not asking you for the exact numbers. I'm not asking you for anything else. I think what I want to illustrate is, has there been a substantial difference that affect the lives of, you know, 1,400 Alaskans here for jobs, plus the trickle down in their communities, as well as all of the folks that work on these different projects? Has it been significant, and can we afford to go back?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, as I mentioned as I went through the slide, we're going to have a substantial maintenance program, renewal program for the foreseeable future. I don't see that really coming to an end. But the thing that's different, as you take a look at CD5, about 600 jobs there, and you take a look at the other jobs that I mentioned for drill site 2S and the drilling rigs, those CD5 is a proxy for all those other projects that I talked about. You know, GMT1 will have about the same level of employment. If there are other developments out in NPRA, you can probably see similar sorts of things. If there's new drill sites like I talked about in Kaparik, you're going to see that kind of demand for employment. So the difference that we're seeing here is in those 700 or so jobs there that are coming up because the different projects that we're now moving ahead on with regard to since SB 21 was passed. So I think, you will see a decrease in the level of employment on the North Slope if we go backwards. I think it's very likely that will happen. But again, it comes back to, what decisions get made if we go backwards under that. And at this point in time, you know, it's hard to speculate what would happen under a different set of circumstances, particularly the negative circumstances that going back to ACES would create. But what I can tell you is it is not positive. It will not help. It will not improve the decision to invest in Alaska. So I hope we don't have to go back there.
Good. Further questions for Scott? Seeing none, thank you very much for being here today and for testifying. Next up, we have Exxon, and that will be Sophia Wong presenting. Sophia? Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Giesel and members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today and to provide you with an update of the Point Thompson project. For the record, my name is Sophia Wong. I'm with ExxonMobil, and I'm currently the infrastructure and pipeline project manager for Point Thompson. I've been working on the project since 2009. We're currently wrapping up our second winter season of construction, and we've completed a number of infrastructure milestones that demonstrate our ongoing commitment to Alaska's energy future. Now, although Point Thompson is an initial production system, it's a first phase, the estimated cost for the infrastructure, for the gas processing facility, and the wells is expected to be in the range of $4 billion. To date, ExxonMobil has invested about half of that, about $2 billion, on the development, of which about 70% of that has been spent in Alaska. So we're certainly excited by what the project is contributing to Alaska. First, it's opening new portions of the North Slope. Second, we're establishing infrastructure for future development. We are investing in Alaskans' human resources. And lastly, it's a strategic next step toward North Slope gas development. I'd like to start off with a little background on myself. As I mentioned, I'm working with ExxonMobil. I've been with Exxon now for 16 years, of which the last 5 years have been spent working on Point Thompson. I moved with my husband and three kids to Anchorage on August of 2009, and we really consider ourselves blessed to be living in the beautiful state of Alaska. From a personal standpoint, I can't think of a better place to raise a young family. Having grown up in the suburbs of Washington, D.C., I've had the opportunity to travel and live in many different parts of the world, and I really just can't think of a better place than Alaska to raise my three kids and my husband. So one of the things that makes Point Thompson unique, even on the North Slope, is its location. You can see on this map how remote it is. We're about 60 miles to the east of Prudhoe Bay and the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and right next to ANWR, the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. A challenge we face is producing this large resource space in a safe and environmentally sound manner. However, we have taken steps to ensure a minimal environmental footprint with summer coastal barging, winter ice roads, and comprehensive mitigation measures to minimize impact on the tundra, wildlife, aquatic resources, and subsistence activities. So the Point Thompson project will provide access to the Thompson Sand Reservoir, which contains an estimated 8 trillion cubic feet of gas and 200 million barrels of condensate. That's about 25% of the known reserves of gas on the slope. And Point Thompson builds on the expertise and success of other North Slope developments like Prudhoe Bay. And we're also bringing ExxonMobil's Arctic experience from around the world to help execute the project. This initial production facility consists of three primary wells, one producer, and two injection wells, which are directionally drilled from shore to minimize environmental footprint. Now, this gas processing facility is going to have the capacity to cycle 200 million cubic feet of gas and produce up to 10,000 barrels per day of condensate. We're also building a 12-inch export pipeline that's going to link us to the Badami Common Carrier Pipeline. Now, I would like to stress that the 10,000 barrels per day is only the initial amount of condensate. And condensate is, you know, premium liquids like diesel. When completed, the pipeline has a capacity to transport 70,000 barrels per day. So ultimately, Point Thomson is a double win. It's gas for the LNG project and increased throughput for the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Now, additionally, the Point Thomson project does establish the critical infrastructure for future expansion. Development of Point Thomson is essential to Alaska natural gas commercialization. The next couple of slides, I'm going to show you the progression of our site starting back in October of 2012 to a first oil in the end of 2015, early 2016. So to appreciate what we've accomplished in the last 18 months of construction, I wanted to begin by showing you what we had at site back in October of 2012 when the Corps of Engineers issued our main 404 permit. As you can see on this photo, all we had was a 13-acre pad of rig mats, a small helipad, and two orange wellhead covers for the PTU-15 and PTU-16 wells that we drilled back in 2010. Here is a picture a few months later. You can see in the summer, last summer, where we were barging in two sea lift modules for our permanent fuel storage. And here's 1 year later, after we got our permit, and you can see that we had built already a year later a little village at Point Thomson. There's a few key components to the infrastructure that I'd like to point out. At the very top, on the north end of our central pad, we have the service pier that we used to offload the four diesel storage tanks that you can see towards the middle top of the photo. You can also see on the bottom right-hand corner, kind of the blue buildings, that's our permanent operations camp. As well, just in front of that, you can see our telecommunications tower. To the left of that are most of the temporary construction camps that we're currently using for the work going on the slope. So now looking at a more recent photo, just a couple of weeks ago, you can see the ice road right-of-way that carries the export pipeline and the west gathering line to our central pad facilities in the background. And here, too, is a very recent photo of the central pad and its continued expansion. So you can see kind of on the top side in the gray area, that's where we're currently placing gravel over, you know, once we remove the rig mats. And besides the gravel, some of the additional infrastructure that, for those of you who were there in November, who got to see the site that we have added since then, we've got additional camps that we mobilized for the pipeline scope of work. We also have the two cold storage tents that you can see there near the crane. And then right where the crane is located, you can see where we were installing piles and the foundations for two of our buildings, the warehouse and our ACS maintenance building. And so now I'm just going to quickly show you some of the work that's coming up here in the near future. This is a depiction of our central pad, and you can see on the right-hand side is the gravel that we had laid last year. Last year we laid about almost a million cubic yards of gravel, and this year we're laying the rest of the gravel on the left-hand side. And we're currently on target. We've laid about 750,000 cubic yards of a million, roughly, that we're doing this next season. So in good shape. I mentioned already the ACS and maintenance building. We're just starting the foundation work for that. And also the sea lift bulkhead. You can see that on there. Moving on to 2015, next winter season, we're going to have the drill rig come back to Central Pad. We're going to be recompleting the PTU-15 and PTU-16 wells, as well as drilling the disposal well. You can also see that we're going to be installing the piles for all the process modules. And then one of the significant milestones that will be coming up will be in the summer of 2015, where we'll be barging in four large sea lift modules. They're about the size of a football field, and we'll be connecting those kind of like Legos. It's called plug and play. So that by 2016, our plan is to be producing through the initial production system and into taps. So the pictures make it look pretty simple, but it's going to take strong contractors and a strong team of resources to execute the project. So including our permanent operations camp at the end of the project, we will have leveraged the skilled workforce and available facilities to build over 130 truckable modules right here in Alaska. So one of the things I'd like to share with you is my first vision of our Point Thompson family tree. Having grown up in the Washington, D.C. area, I was very fond of the cherry blossoms that are blooming this time of the year in April. And most of you are probably more familiar with this version of our contractor tree. As you can see, there's actually 92 companies that are involved with the project. But the next slide is the one that I'm really proud of, because you can see that out of those, we have 73 companies that are Alaskan companies. So Point Thompson is providing wide-reaching benefits to Alaskan businesses, to Native corporations, and Alaska communities in the form of revenues and jobs. Now, although it does take a multitude of contractors to build this project, I want to take a moment to highlight a few of those contractors and how we've benefited working together. So the first one I want to talk about is AFC, Alaska Frontier Constructors. And for 2014, they've helped us build a 48-mile ice road from Endicott to Point Thompson. Now, we use this ice road to transport equipment, personnel, and materials to the Point Thompson site. The ice roads were built we also have ice roads around the central pad to support construction, and those total about 15 miles. AFC is an Alaskan company, and they're constructing and maintaining our ice road infrastructure, which is critical to supporting construction during the winter. Also, AFC is extending our central pad to about 50 acres and expects to, like I mentioned earlier, haul an additional million cubic yards of gravel, of which, as I said already, we're about 750,000 cubic yards. They're also, AFC is going to be helping us finish the sea lift bulkhead that we'll be using to offload the facility modules in the summer of 2015, as well as they're helping us with the installation of the foundations for the other buildings that we looked at. One of the things that AFC recently concluded was the construction of our west pad. They finished laying all the gravel there, and they are now close to finishing the road to the west pad, including the three bridges. At peak, just a few weeks ago, AFC had about 240 people at our central pad, and they are a key player in all fronts of our infrastructure development. Recently, I was at a presentation at the Ketchikan Chamber of Commerce on March 21st, where I met Patty Mackey with the Ketchikan Visitors Bureau, and her son's working for AFC at Point Thompson, and she was very pleased to see what her son's doing to help us support Point Thompson. A second contractor I want to highlight is Doyen Associated. They are helping us build our pipeline. Last year, they're building upon the work they did where they had installed approximately 2,300 vertical support members between Badami and Point Thompson. Now, we're currently anticipating by the end of this month that our 22-mile, 12-inch export pipeline will be completed, and that includes 27 miles of ice pads along the pipeline route. Now, all the double joining work for this pipeline was completed in the last few months in Fairbanks by Flowline, which is also another Alaskan company. So at peak, just a couple of weeks ago, Doyen had about 315 people working on the pipeline scope. A third company I want to highlight is PRL, Pacific Rim Logistics, and they're our main logistics provider at Point Thompson. They manage the flow of our material, people, and equipment, which is a complex operation when you think of how remote we are. The company, PRL, has seen tremendous growth over the last few years. They've got 120 people working at site and an additional 200 people working for their subcontractors, of which whom about 95% are Alaskans. So last Saturday, I attended the open house for PRL's new facility in Kenai. And combined with the woman from Ketchikan, I wanted to share with you two recent examples of how our work on the slope is making an impact statewide. So it's not just the folks in Anchorage and Fairbanks who are benefiting from our small IPS project. Now, as we complete the infrastructure and the pipeline work, we will transition to focus on installing the gas processing facilities. Another Alaskan company, CH2M Hill, will begin to mobilize and install the flow lines from the wellheads to the facility. They will also do the facility module installation in 2015 that we saw in the previous graphics. Now, the last companies I'm going to highlight, the first one is Morris Engineering. They're based in Juneau, and they provided the design and construction oversight services for all of the construction of our airstrip. The other company, Builder's Choice, out of the Mat-Su Valley, they constructed our Point Thompson, the permanent operations camp that we looked at there in the picture, known as the Carrick, which currently is housing 200 people at site and will be the long-term housing our operations team. Now, Builder's Choice has expanded to over 300 employees with operations in the Dakotas as well. So if you look at the peak manpower that just happened a couple of weeks ago at Central Pad in March, we had more than 729 positions on the slope. And you need to take into consideration that a lot of those positions are rotational. So there's a lot more people than just 729 impacted by the work going on at Point Thompson. Statewide, we estimate about 1,200 positions, of which 85% are Alaskans. And as we saw on our family tree, 92 companies, of which 73 are Alaskan. We're very proud of those numbers. So in summary, now I've shown you the progress we've made at Point Thompson to complete the infrastructure milestones needed for first oil into TAPS by early 2016. Through this infrastructure, we're making investment toward commercialization of the gas. And through the support and hard work of all of our contractors, it is clear that Point Thompson is an Alaskan project built by Alaskans for the benefit of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, Sophia, for your presentation. Questions for Sophia?
Just a more of a comment.
Senator French.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a comment. My tour of Point Thompson last year was one of the highlights of 2013. Sophia and her team gave us an excellent look around at what's happening there. The money that's being spent is impressive. The attention to safety is as high as I've ever seen in my time on the slope. And I just wanted to thank you again for that nice trip.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the comments.
Very good. Senator Machiki had a question.
Yes, Madam Chair. Just a couple, well, a quick one, actually. This is obviously not built for 10,000 barrels per day. So what are the ultimate hopes of Point Thompson?
Well, to me, I refer back to the picture of my family. So it's for the future. It's the next phase of Point Thompson. So at ExxonMobil, we believe, you know, that Senate Bill 21 provides the fiscal stability that our industry needs for future phases at Point Thompson and other Alaskan opportunities. So that's, you know, we have done some of the pre-investment. As I mentioned, that pipeline is designed for up to 70,000 barrels per day. So that is the hope, is that we will have both additional liquids and the natural gas at 8 trillion cubic feet of gas. If you think about that, that's enough energy to heat all our homes in Alaska for 88 plus years. That's the prize.
Madam Chair.
Very good. Follow-up, Senator Machiki?
A couple of quick ones. Thanks for the call-out on PRL. And I know Senator Giesel and I, if we weren't swamped, would have both been there for the opening. That's exciting. My other one is my recommendation to Exxon is that they send you back next time you come here. It's a compliment. I appreciated your testimony very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Any other questions for Sophia? Seeing none, thank you very much. Great. Our last presenter today is Frank Pasband from BP Exploration Alaska.
Where all the gravel come from? I forgot to ask that.
Welcome.
So, senators, thank you for having me here today. My name is Frank Pasquan, and I am the Alaska Technology Manager for BP. Just to share a little bit about myself, I've been doing reservoir engineering and oil field development planning for 29 years. I was born and raised in Fairbanks and went to the University of Alaska for a petroleum engineering degree. And I'm on the University Foundation Board of Trustees and on the College of Engineering and Mines Advisory Board. So go Nanooks. So I'm very happy to be here today to share our ideas and plans that we have for the North Slope operations. And it is worth mentioning that this is based on a snapshot of our plans, which are subject to change from time to time. So turning to slide 2, BP is actively investing in Alaska's North Slope oil fields, and we're acquiring new seismic data in the North Prudhoe Bay field. We're adding 2 new rigs, which will bring on 200 new jobs, $1 billion over 5 years. We're currently operating 7 rigs on the North Slope, and that will bring it to 9. In addition to the rigs, we're investing in new development technology completions, which will help advantage our developments in the challenging oil fields, for example, the Sag River resource. I'm happy to report that we've restarted development drilling in Milne Point in 2014, and I'll share a little bit more about that in a minute. And we're in the appraise and select stage of engineering for the west end of Prudhoe Bay project, which has potential startup in 2018, $3 billion investment with peak production on the order of 40,000 barrels a day. So in addition to the new facilities, we're also making major facility investments committing to safe and sustainable operations. For example, the turnarounds in 2014 are a substantial piece of work. We're employing 700 people on the North Slope to deliver that work, which took 2 years to plan for that. And an example of that would be the GC2, Gathering Center 2 module, which is built at NANA's Big Lake facility, which was 79 jobs, cost around $13 million, and will bring on about 2,000 barrels a day. So all in all, our capital investment has increased 25% for 2014 to $1.2 billion. And this includes a 40% increase in capital for activities that increase oil production, namely drilling, well work, and major projects. So turning to slide 3, this is a locator map which shows the Prudhoe Bay unit and the Milne Point unit where most of my discussion today will center. And I would like to first point out in the northeast side of the map, the North Prudhoe area, where we're acquiring seismic data this summer, followed by offshore, followed by an onshore program this winter. And if you see in the underlay of the Prudhoe Bay outline, you can see the tracery of all the various drill sites in Prudhoe and as you go up into Milne Point and Endicott. And we operate over 1,600 wells within that footprint and keep 7 drilling rigs running there 24/7, 365. So it's quite an operation. So moving from there to the west end of the field, we'll discuss briefly the west end development project. And then north of there, the Milne Point, where we actually have a drilling rig running there right now and restarted the development. So I'll touch on each of these areas in the following slides. So let me start first in the North Prudhoe Bay seismic area. So seismic data is kind of like an ultrasound image. It lets us image and remotely assess the potential oil field drilling locations. And it takes a few years to go from the data acquisition through processing, interpretation, and then development planning before you start the development drilling that follows from that. And the first wells based on this 2014-15 data acquisition may be drilled starting in 2017. So the seismic acquisition should involve 150 jobs, around $78 million in spend, and an image across 4 different production horizons, which have about 55 million barrels of resource potential. And from its name, Prudhoe Bay, it's easy to recognize these fields are close to the shoreline. And so you see in the images there that some of the fields that are onshore and they extend into the near shore region. So our seismic survey acquisition plan, therefore, is both the onshore program and the offshore program. So the offshore part shown on the top of the slide, uses boats for deeper water and what's called an Arctos vehicle for the shallower water. We'll be acquiring about 190 square miles of offshore data this summer, and during this winter season, around 220 square miles to image the area accurately to enable, you know, precise well planning and development assessments. So on to the development and drilling part of the business. So drilling and well operations are one of our most visible and significant areas of investment. We operate a fleet of well service equipment with which we perform over 500 oil rate improving jobs per year in those 1,600 wells. And we've got seven rigs currently operating, two what are called workover rigs, which are used to repair and maintain existing wells, two coiled tubing drilling wells, and this is really an Alaska developed and matured technology. Coiled tubing is a continuous coil of steel tubing, which can be more than 15,000 feet long, and that goes down through the existing well bore and drills to a new target that can be up to a half a mile away from the parent well bore. So it's a very efficient way of accessing targets and improving oil rate from within the legacy fields. Plus, we have three rotary drilling rigs which drill new wells from the surface, or they can drill sidetracks similar to what I just described with coiled tubing drilling. So with this fleet in 2014, we plan to drill to 61 new targets and work over, coincidentally, 61 new wells. We've started up three new rotary rigs since 2011, rigs that we built specifically to meet the North Slope needs. And we're planning for another two big rotary wells, which would bring us up to nine rigs. These new rigs would involve 200 jobs and $1 billion of investment over 5 years. And we'll take our rig level from where it was in 2012 at five rigs to a total of nine rigs. So as you might imagine, the logistics of this operation are enormous. I mean, one example of this is the roads have to be specifically built for the size and weight of these drilling rigs. And we're making substantial investments in road upgrades this year to more easily and efficiently move rigs around both summer and winter. And as I mentioned, in Milne Point, we've restarted the development drilling there. We've finished four wells, we're on our fifth, and have two more planned, and planned similar levels of drilling for the next several years. So it's worth noting that our last new wells were drilled back in 2011, so it's nice to see that activity picking up there. On to the next slide. In Prudhoe Bay and the west end of the field, we're working hard on the select stage phase of the project, okay? The select stage means we're doing the engineering that's needed to make the best investment choices that will enable us to manage production for the long term in the West End. So this suite of projects you can see on the pictures there is an image of a new well pad named iPad, which is the first would be the first new pad in Prudhoe in more than a decade. And we would add production to two other existing well pads that are shown in the upper right-hand side image, plus the optimizing our facilities by increasing flow line capacity and adding other surface facility equipment. And this would collectively add over 100 new wells in the west end of Prudhoe and about 200 million more barrels of oil production. And we see West End with potential startup in 2018. With $3 billion of investment, and that would bring on an estimated 40,000 barrels a day. And then finally, another very big activity in Prudhoe this year is our planned facility shutdowns, which are starting in July. So these are maintenance and system upgrade projects in three major facilities. The biggest being the central gas facility and then the production processing flow station 3 and gathering center 2. So these are called turnarounds or planned maintenance shutdowns, and we expect them to last but depending on the facility, between 30 days to just over 50 days. And these are tremendous operations that are well choreographed, and it took over 2 years of planning to get ready for this work. We will have around 700 people in the field, in and around those facilities, and we manage the operations so we can get the work executed in a minimum amount of time to minimize the production impacts of that and get it done safely. So the kinds of work that we're doing during this operation are refurbishing aging compressors, making process and safety improvements, repairing heating exchangers, replacing old valves, to set these facilities up for long-term operations for the long and smooth running. And this is, as you can see on the pictures there, one of the technologies that we use for this work, I'm a technology guy, so I have to share this. It's a, we use laser point cloud generated images for super accurate measurements, and so we scan the facility before we do any design work so we can very accurately know the position of all the equipment. And then before we cut into any pipes or do any fabrication or design work, we get that super accurate scan and ensure a perfect fit for the new replacement equipment. So taken together, our capital investment has increased 25% for 2014 to $1.2 billion. And this includes a substantial increase, 40% in capital for rate adding activities. And that really concludes my prepared remarks. I'm happy to take any questions.
Great. Thank you very much, Frank. Questions for Frank on any of the presentations? Senator Dyson.
Think. Getting into some heavier oil further west you go?
Yes, there is. On the west side of the field, there's heavy oil accumulations that, start within Prudhoe, Milne, and Kuparuk. Yeah. So we're evaluating that and continuing to do engineering analysis for the heavy oil. In particular, we learned from the heavy oil CHOPS pilot at Milne Point SPAD that there's definitely ongoing technical and commercial challenges for that area. So the one of the main studies that we're doing and the biggest problem that we ran into during the operation was the artificial lift. We used a rotating rod that runs from a surface drive through the well, and what we were seeing is that it rapidly wore holes in the side of the tubing. And in that abrasive environment with sand on metal on metal. So we're looking at, we're doing studies now on artificial lift and hope that that will improve the run life, because these workovers and tubing replacements were very expensive and made it difficult to continue the operations of the pilot.
Follow-up, Senator Dyson?
No, I guess not. Thank you, though. I'm encouraged.
So are we.
Further questions for Mr. Pascan?
Sure, Madam Chair.
Senator French.
Got a minute. Thanks. Nice to see you here. Aren't you in those ads?
30 seconds of fame.
I've seen them a lot. My question is about slide five. And you gave us your job title. I'm sorry, I didn't write it down. Your job title is?
Alaska Technology Manager.
Technology Manager, okay. And so if I were to ask you which of those investments were not economical to make under ACES, is that in your wheelhouse or is that in someone else's wheelhouse?
That really sits within a different wheelhouse, per se.
Yeah. I'll just let it go.
As an observer, I can just see that we're moving ahead with those developments now.
Sure.
It's good to see.
Sure. I'm sure that feels good. And I'll just offer my own comment that I'd love to sit in on a family discussion on this subject with you and your brother sometime.
We would love to have you.
Thanks so much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Great. Senator Machicki, question?
I have Mr. Pascan. It's good to have you here. I've got a similar question. And it's nice to have somebody from the field that's not one of those stakeholder guys. So let's look at page five. And, you know, you talk about
7 rigs performing new well and sidetrack drilling, 61 new sidetrack projects, 61 new workovers, 3 new rotary drilling rigs, 9 rigs from 7 currently investment in rows drilling at Milne Point. Is that real? Is that real since the investment climate? I mean, I'm going to ask, I've asked all of you that point blank, and I think Alaskans need to hear it. Is it real? Did it happen because of 21? Will it be somewhat retracted if the investment climate is less favorable?
Well, it is real. It's we are working actively to plan and get ready for this equipment, and we're making it happen. If things change in the business climate, it's going to cause us and our co-owners in these ventures to go back and relook at everything under the new whatever the changes that might come to pass.
Follow up?
Yes, follow up, Senator Maticki.
We're probably similar ages, similar lengths of service. So here's my question for you: is this rig count? We count them differently now that we've got coil tubing units and such. So is this rig count from days of when we had very, very healthy exploration? How would you compare?
It's on a par with the at least within BP-operated assets. So I think we were running 11 at one point back in 2006. But getting to 9 rigs, and wells make oil, so we like to drill. And the more we do, I think the better off we'll be.
Very good. Any other questions for Mr. Pascagon? Great. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you to all the companies that presented today, including Deputy Commissioner Tengerman. It was very informative, and I appreciate you being here. So in terms of next meetings, committee members, keep this time slot on your calendar. We'll see moving forward what comes up coming from the House side in terms of House bills. But one thing certain at this point anyway, as certain as anyone can predict the future, is Wednesday, April 16th. That's next Wednesday at 8 a.m. The Support Industry Alliance will be back. They were scheduled on Monday. Of course, we had to cancel because of floor session. So they are going to come back, and we'll have an 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. meeting on that Wednesday. So we'll keep you informed, and for the public, keep watching basis for the next meeting. So at this time, we'll adjourn. The time is 5:25 p.m. Thank you very much.